Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How can art communicate both the events of history and the deeper truths they represent? When artist Hale Woodruff was commissioned to paint murals for Talladega College's new library in 1938, he created three works depicting the slave ship Amistad and its mutinous passengers' long fight for justice, another celebrating the legacy of the Underground Railroad, and two more focused on the history of Talladega College. Woodruff always hoped the six panels would reach an audience beyond the school and its students, and now the exhibition Rising Up, Hale Woodruff's Murals at Talladega College, is on display at the African American Museum of Dallas through the end of February. Joining us to talk about it are Dr. Harry Robinson, who is president of the African American Museum of Dallas, and retired curator Philip Collins. Gentlemen, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
I want to start by talking a little bit about Hale Woodruff himself. He was born in 1900, moved to France when he was 27. What sort of art training had he had before he left the States?
He went to the Heron Institute in Indianapolis. He studied at the Fogg at Harvard, and he studied at the Art Institute in Chicago.
So he was ready to go when he got to Paris,
yes,
certainly.
Yes.
And like so many young artists of that era, it seems like in a lot of ways he came alive in terms of exploring new things in Paris.
That is correct. And while in Paris, he also visited with the expatriate African-American artist Henry Osava Tanner, who was there and sort of served as a mentor or guide to him through the maze of the art scene there in Paris. And there in Paris, he got involved with modernism, you know, the painting of the period there with Braque and Picasso and these gentlemen of that time, and Cézanne in particular, and that is reflected in the earlier works that are in the exhibition at the museum as well.
Yeah, it's really interesting. We get to see him experimenting with different styles, and it seems like mastering all of them, but then finally settling on what he loved to do.
Yes.
He was also influenced by Orozco, and he studied under Diego Rivera in Mexico.
Yeah, there was a period of in African American art history that the artists here in the United States went to Mexico to study with the Mexican muralist. And of course, Hale Woodruff was with that group of artists like Elizabeth Catlett, John Alston, John Biggers, he from Texas and the like. These artists all went there to be introduced to how to influence their work with social activism.
Mm-hmm. And that obviously was something that Rivera was very experienced at doing. How did Woodruff's work change after that summer that he spent in Mexico?
Well, it changed.
Or evolved, maybe that's a better word.
Yeah, well, it evolved not directly away from the appearance of what he was doing. Prior to that, all of that classical training that he had, but it transformed or it evolved into a definite sense of social responsibility in documenting history and social activism, and his work moved in that direction. And of course, these murals, as you can see, at that time, during that time period, to do something so daring like that in the South where there's Jim Crow and all of this was going on, it was amazing for him to be able to think about presenting on such a large scale such type of information, so to speak.
And he also, after this period of time that Philip was talking about, he depicted life in the South as it really was. He did some work, and you will see that at the museum, where he did some murals on poor housing, the result of poor housing. Then he did something that was juxtaposed to that on good housing in Atlanta. And he did some murals in the public housing projects in Atlanta, and there were several other locations in the South where he did these murals. I remember I was a librarian in another life and went to library school at Atlanta University, which was strictly a graduate school in those days. There were five colleges, arts and sciences, business, library science, social work, education. And in that library, in the trouble on that library, after Hale, by the way, when Hale did the murals at Talladega, he was on the faculty at Atlanta University. And he drove from Atlanta to Talladega on weekends to teach art. And the president at that time, Bill Gallagher, who was a Quaker, I believe, commissioned Hale to do these murals, you know, as the literature states, to commemorate the mutiny on the Amistad and to commemorate the to celebrate the opening of the new library with something depicting the opening of the school. But while I was at Atlanta University, I had a chance to see some other murals that Hale had done in the Trevor Arnett Library. And it chronicles the contribution of African American to art, to African American art and to art in this country. And then and later on in life, I worked in Alabama and had a relationship with Talladega College, with the librarian who wrote one of the essays. And we all thought those murals were painted into the surface, but they were not. They were on canvas. So after learning that the murals at Talladega were painted on canvases, I talked to one or two of the graduates from Talladega, and I said, oh, but I think the ones at Atlanta University are in the wall. But later on, I discovered that those were painted. There were six panels. They were painted on mural on a canvas also. So there was sort of like a personal experience with Hale Woodruff. We talked about his education and the influence of others, but we didn't talk about his connection to Dallas. In 1936, Hale Woodruff was one of the artists who exhibited in the Hall of Negro Life in Fair Park. And the Hall of Negro Life was on a site which is now occupied by the African American Museum in Dallas.
So it's like a homecoming to have his work here.
Yes, it's a homecoming. And we talk about that sometime, that this is a homecoming for Hale Woodruff.
When you talk about the influences that, that were important to Hale Woodruff, one thing that I think is fascinating, and this came up in the mural that you mentioned about the African-American contribution to art, he became really interested when he was in Paris in collecting African art. Is that right?
That is correct. He did collect African art, and because he was interested in the aesthetics of how to infuse that, if I might use that word, into his nomenclature or iconography of how he was going to depict African-American life and culture and how he wanted to project this idea of what it is to be African-American and the conditions if they were in. Going back not just to Paris, but there was also the influence of the Mexican muralist when he was there in Mexico. He also did printmaking. And what he learned from lino cut and the other techniques there in printmaking was the idea of how to infuse African-American conditions in that. And there are some very interesting pieces at the African American Museum in this exhibition that represent the poor conditions and the tragic conditions that African Americans were experiencing during that period. They include lynching, as well as day laborers, and then some refined things as Sunday morning church scenes and things like that. But he was using the power of this simple format of printmaking that he was influenced by the Mexican muralists into his work as well. And so I think it had a great impact on him, his travel, not just to Europe, but to Mexico as well.
And in his work at Atlanta University in the library, you can see he was responding in a way to the challenge of Alain Locke. This was the philosopher who started and encouraged African-American artists to fall back on their heritage, the African heritage, do some things. And if you look at the murals that were done in Atlanta University Library, you can see that influence, and is similar to what one of his fellow muralists who was here in Dallas, Aaron Douglas, who was at Fisk for a while, who used all of these African figures and the Picasso influence and all of that stuff in those murals. And you can see Hill trying to respond to that like some of the other African-American artists. Remember, it was just after the Harlem Renaissance, which was during the 20s and the early 30s. And that's when Hill was doing his work, because he came to Atlanta in 1931 and left in 1946 to go to New York University.
You know, going back, Harry, to the two paintings that you mentioned for, I think they were done for the Atlanta Housing Authority,
right.
The Effects of Good Housing, Effects of Poor Housing. It's really remarkable to look at those two next to one another, because in one you see, you know, terrible conditions and these shacks falling down and people really suffering. And in the other one you see a group of individuals that could be the same people, but life is entirely different.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It has improved. The quality of their life has improved in that transition there. Now, there's also, going back to your question about the influences, when you think of his work in Paris, the first image in the exhibition is a painting that I feel is very significant to view when starting this exhibition tour. And it's the old farmhouse that was executed. He painted that in Paris when he was there in France. And this painting does not have any type of indication of African-American life and culture. Mm-hmm. It is a landscape and a old farmhouse and all. And the technique is used. The entire painting was done with palette brushes instead of paint brushes. He used palette knives in this case in doing this painting. Now, he juxtaposition to that is this interesting painting that he did in Atlanta, and it's called Shacks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's interesting about that painting, it shows this poor condition of the African-American there, but it definitely shows the influence of Cézanne in the way that it is composed, and all of the elements involved in that painting is very French during that period. And I find that very fascinating to look at.
There
how he brings that together.
There are a couple of works in the catalog, at least, that may be in the show that look very much like Van Gogh as well.
That is also correct. And I think it's the way the colors are becoming bold and vigorous like that, and big sensual areas of paint and the brush strokes as well.
Now, the Talladega paintings are extremely bold. The colors are extraordinary. You just it takes a while to look at them, just to let your eyes roam over the canvases.
Right. I think there's a great study there between when you look at the drawings. Look at it. Mm-hmm. Imagine it as a drawing first, and then the application of the color onto these drawings that illuminates the paintings themselves.
We are talking about Rising Up, Hale Woodruff's Murals at Talladega College, which is on exhibition through February 28th at the African American Museum of Dallas. With us is the president of the museum, Dr. Harry Robinson, and retired curator Philip Collins. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House Kitchen, lecture, book signing, and hors d'oeuvres, October 16th with Chef John Hanney III. More at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Philip Collins, who is retired curator for the African American Museum of Dallas, and Dr. Harry Robinson, president of the African American Museum of Dallas. On exhibit at the museum through February 28th is Rising Up, Hale Woodruff's Murals at Talladega College. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So I want to talk a little bit about the works themselves, these six murals in particular. The first in the series is The Mutiny on the Amistad, which depicts the true story of an uprising on a Spanish slave ship in 1839. Tell us a little bit about the events that inspired that painting, maybe different from the events in the movie, which I haven't seen, that came out a few years ago. But the events, and then how Woodruff chose to represent them in that panel.
Well, the Hale Woodruff murals depict what we call the first civil rights movement in this country. It was 1839, and these slaves decided they were not going to be slaves. They wanted freedom. And as you go through the episode and they translate what one of the captives is saying is, we want to be free. We want to be free, even though they didn't speak English, but in their own language, they're saying, we want to be free. We want to be free. And there's a lesson in there that the human spirit will just naturally resist being captive. And this happened on the Amistad. And in addition to wanting to be free, the record says that the captive decided they had to do something because the cook or someone on the ship told them that when we land, they're going to chop us up and cook us. So they decided we're going to take our chances and we're going to take over the ship. And they took over the ship. But in the meantime, the commander, those who survived, tricked them during the night. During the day, they knew where they were going because they used the sun. But at night, they tricked them and they kept zigzagging and was on their way back away from where the slaves wanted to go. And they ended up being surrounded, and they were forced back to the United States, and they were put on trial. And this is a major art exhibition, but it's a major history exhibition, and it talks about how a group of people were freed, but they got a lot of help from people who were not slaves. The American Missionary Association, which it later became, which was part of the United, the Congregationalist Church. These were the people who raised the funds to defend these captives after they were brought back to the country, and got a professor from Yale who was fluent in Mende language to translate what these people were talking about. And in addition to that, they finally persuaded John Quincy Adams, the former president, to defend these people. Here a man was 73 years old, hadn't been in court for about 30 years. But anyway, he had certain beliefs about freedom and the Constitution and what this country meant.
And the only one of the early presidents who was not a slaveholder himself.
That's right, because Van Buren gave him some trouble. He was very upset that because of the treaties we had with Spain about slaves. And he tried, and the government tried all it did all it could do to return these slaves back to Spain, because that was a very sensitive issue. They had a treaty with them. But the Supreme Court, by the way, which had five justices who were slave owners, who ruled in favor of the slaves that, you know, they were not property of slaves and they could be freed. But the other lesson that was demonstrated in this whole incident was that the American Missionary Association, in addition to freeing, getting these slaves freed and sent back home, started another effort in this country, and that was to build institutions of higher learning for African Americans. Talladega was one of those institutions. There were several others, Fisk, Tougaloo Christian, Howard University, Hampton, and several others, but Dillard University in New Orleans, and one right here in Texas, Tillotson, which is now Houston-Tillotson. And these institutions supported, I mean, this organization, American Missionary Association, supported these institutions for years. And the Congregationalist Church still supports some of them. Matter of fact, there is a research center in New Orleans called the Amistad Research Center at Tulane University. It was at Dillard at one time, but it's at Tulane. And it is supported by the Congregational Church. But these murals tell a very interesting story about Alabama. In spite of the rigid segregation and all of the other stuff that was going on, these murals paint a picture of community cooperation among the races in Alabama. When that library was built for the being, it was going to be the home for these new murals, the white community joined the African Americans who were trying to get Talladega Library built. And I don't know what motivated them. I guess it really doesn't matter. The point is the help was there and they got this done. So there are certain lessons there that there were people along the way. Same thing with the modern civil rights movement. There were people along the way, like the Jewish community, in addition to other non-African American, but they stood out more vividly because of their work with the NAACP and that kind of stuff. But there are lessons there for generations to come. And we hope it will encourage other people who are seeing injustices done and a lack of fairness taking place, that they will be courageous, or as courageous as these American missionaries, these abolitionists, that's what they were, who stood up and decided, Lewis Tappan and that crowd, decided they were going to do what was right and try to make sure that the country lived up to its true meaning, the Constitution. And that is depicted in those murals, in the Underground Railroad mural, in the opening of the library, when the slaves were sent back. Yeah.
I think it's interesting that even in the first panel that depicts the mutiny on the Amistad, Woodruff chose not to show a lot of bloodshed. Certainly he could have, but he decided not to. Can you talk about that choice?
I think that had something to do with his formal training, and it deals with his approach was not to be gory, but to tell the story with dignity.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't necessarily have to have a lot of blood to explain a situation.
You get what's going on.
You
Absolutely.
Get what's going on in it, and it has a sense of majesty appeal to it that way. It's also interesting to note in those paintings that the image of the faces are actually people who were actually on that ship.
Yeah, they were drawings from life, right?
That is correct. Mm-hmm. Because during the trial scene, they had an artist there, William Spencer, I think is his name, yes, was the artist at the trial, and he captured all of these images for each of the person that was on trial at that event. And Hal Woodruff used those images in portraying the people as they actually were in his paintings.
What I think is so interesting about that is that sometimes when we think about something that happened in the distant past, it's easy to sort of just lump everyone together as opposed to taking individuals. And it seems like certainly white representations of African American history have often failed to find the individual stories and sort of taken a large group of people. And it really seems like Woodruff's commitment to showing the facial features of these particular individuals makes a point.
Oh, yeah. I think it's very important. And reflecting back on my experience with African American painting and art in general, there is something that is very majestic about it. And I think that this comes from their influence, being influenced through African art. When you look at the sculpture and all how it's all put together, the formality of it. And this held back to what Dr. Robinson was saying earlier about the mandate for African Americans
by Alain Locke, by African Americans to look back at their own history to create an identity. And it's probably a part of that principal element to depict things in a formal way.
Am I correct about this, that for some reason there was not a drawing of Joseph Tsinke, if I'm saying that name correctly, Tsinke, that Woodruff did not have a model for him and had to sort of imagine what he looked like? Or was there was one prominent member of the defendants who was not represented that Woodruff had to sort of create?
I'm not sure of that one.
No. He does, though, in the scene of the trial, there is a sort of cameo of the artist himself.
Yes.
Which I think is wonderful.
Yes.
It's wonderful.
Yeah. He's a witness to
the
proceedings in his painting, yes.
And, I mean, it's certainly taken very seriously, but it does show a kind of a both a curiosity about history and a fraternal sense that he could have been there at the same time were he not born in the time that he was.
Right.
Okay, so let's talk about the third painting in the series, which is really interesting. This is the repatriation of the captives from the Amistad. What do we see in that painting?
We see a group of people with a boat in the background, some waving happily about returning, and then you see the decision of those who decide to stay on shore in that same painting. And you have this mixture of emotions going on in this particular painting. And surprisingly enough, some of the missionaries there went back with them to help them establish a place in Africa for them to go to, you know. And that's where we get the establishment of the country Liberia comes out of that situation.
And there were some defendants that chose to remain in the United States after they were declared free.
Yes.
And what sort of lives did they have and what sort of role did they play in, particularly in the establishment of new educational institutions for African Americans?
I don't know if they did because I know Mende, Tsinke, he died just an ordinary citizen and, back home. It was an old fable, broke.
So I suppose after they were there was no additional help once they stayed in this country. They just had to build lives for themselves and get on with it.
I don't know. I haven't seen any discussion about that.
Yeah.
The only follow-up I know of is the development of the colleges and institutions for the education of the newly freed African.
And then you had the development of the Freedmen's Bureau, too, that gave them aid and assisted them in many ways as well.
So I suppose the panels are really in two different series, and in the second series, the first one is this wonderful, wonderful representation of the Underground Railroad, which really seems to have represented so much hope, even for people who would never be able to benefit from what it was doing.
It was very important, the Underground Railroad. And there's an interesting point that Hale Woodruff makes in the connection of the paintings from the trial scene to the Underground Railroad. There is a gentleman in that painting, and for the moment I'm...
Louis Tappan?
That's right, Mr. Tappan. Was at the trial, and he was one of the persons who was there helping and supporting the captives.
He was a ringleader.
At the trial, yes. Now, when you see the painting of the Underground Railroad, there's a beautiful story there. There's a gentleman, a missionary, sitting there giving... with a child, a slave child, a free person, a slave being able to get to the south, get to the north, sitting in his lap. And Mr. Tappan has in his hand a letter to where this child is supposed to be delivered.
Hmm.
And it is addressed to Mr. Tappan.
Hmm. So clearly things are going to go well for the boy. Tappan was an abolitionist.
Kid was going to be delivered. See, and that the trial was in Connecticut, so he was somewhere in the north, somewhere. You see,
mm-hmm.
I think, like in the mural of the Amistad Revolt, you see the same thing in the Underground Railroad. That here you had determination and courage. And people were determined, they were hungry for freedom, and they were determined to do whatever they were going to do, had to do. As one of our public programs, we have a one-act play on Harriet Tubman, who was the conductor of the Underground Railroad, and she was considered the Moses of her people. So it's a play for young people between grades 3rd and 6th. It's a 45-minute play by a local author, children's book author here named Willie Welch. And he has engaged an African-American woman to play the role of Harriet Tubman. And it shows the courageousness. And when they were talking to Harriet Tubman, and they were congratulating her on how many slaves she had freed. You took about 300 folks out of slavery on the Underground Railroad. And she said, yes, I freed hundreds of slaves. I could have freed more, but they didn't know they were slaves.
Hmm. That's an interesting story. We are speaking this hour with Dr. Harry Robinson, president of the African American Museum of Dallas, and Philip Collins, retired curator of the museum. The exhibition Rising Up, Hale Woodruff's Murals at Talladega College, is on display at the African American Museum of Dallas through February 28th of next year. If you'd like to join our conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House Kitchen, lecture, book signing, and hors d'oeuvres, October 16th with Chef John Hanney III. More at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Philip Collins, retired curator for the African American Museum of Dallas, and Dr. Harry Robinson, president of the African American Museum of Dallas, which has the exhibition Rising Up, Hale Woodruff's Murals at Talladega College on display through February 28th of next year. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I love the panel that follows the one about the Underground Railroad for the founding of Talladega College, because you see these lines of hopeful students, all men at the time, carrying any number of things with them to pay for their education. They didn't have money, but they wanted an education and they were going to get it. Tell us about that panel.
Well, that was in 1867, but the truth be told, there wasn't much of a difference later on in the life of these historically black colleges. Because if you go to Tuskegee Institute, which was founded in 1882 by Booker T, 1881 by Booker T. Washington, the kids didn't bring stuff like chicken, poultry, and you saw the poultry and
right.
all kinds
mm-hmm.
of stuff, vegetables and what have you, put away, sugar cane. Mm-hmm. I don't know what sugar they do in Alabama, but anyway, they had sugar cane. Might be it came from Florida or Louisiana. But they had sugar cane and other type products. But if you go to Tuskegee and Hampton Institute, the kids didn't bring any food, didn't bring any money, but they worked their way through college. And at Tuskegee, many of the buildings were built by students.
Hmm.
The chapel at Tuskegee which is, you know, very famous architecture at Tuskegee and Hampton. They were built by the students, so it didn't change that much. And you can go on up to Oakwood College, which is in Huntsville, Alabama, and the kids are required to work to pay some of their tuition through college. So it's a carry-on from 1867 up to this point. And that tradition was very prevalent in African-American, not only for education, but for medical care. There were people who went to doctors, they couldn't afford them, so they gave them produce, vegetables, poultry, and that kind of stuff. So it was just part of a tradition that they bartered what they had to get what they need. And you see that back in 1867. But what was so interesting was here were people who were newly freed citizens who were determined to get an education and whatever it took. That's what they did. And the other fascinating part of that is how these administrators, as they would say in the country, made do with what the kids brought there to keep those institutions going.
It's hard to pay your professors with chickens and sugar cane,
but they
had it happening.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Now, you got to remember that most of the teachers, especially in those AMA schools, were not African Americans. I remember when Talladega and Tougaloo College had white presidents. And it wasn't until 1929 that Bishop College, which was founded in 1881, had a black president. So you had a lot of white teachers from northern United States. Matter of fact, some of the Baptist schools were founded by the Northern Baptists, which later became American Baptists. So the presidents were white, the teachers were white, and they came with a classical education. So they were not teaching African American studies or African American sociology. No. They were teaching Greek, Latin, Hebrew, and what have you. So if you deal with some of these graduates of these institutions back in up until the 40s, they were classical studies. And the feeling was in those historically black colleges that if you gave us a good liberal arts education, you can go on to wherever else you want to do. And you will find that in those AMA schools, over 50% of the students went straight to graduate or professional schools. Hmm. And if you look at the record, you will see where the doctors, the lawyers, and the leaders went to Talladega, Fisk, and some of these other AMA schools. And as young as I am, when we went to college, we could not pursue a major until after we had taken 60 hours of what they called, we didn't know what it was, but it was called liberal arts education.
Mm-hmm. So make your choice after you've had some exposure to big ideas.
And they did a very good job of teaching these people.
From a visual aspect, your question about them bordering and all, and Dr. Robinson referring to the sugarcane being in Alabama there, I think that was an artistic decision that Hill Woodruff made to remind us from the beginning the sugarcane on the ship was used as a weapon. Hmm. They used those to make their machetes with. And in this painting of the opening day at Talladega in Alabama, to have the sugarcane on a man's back and he's walking off the canvas in the background is saying that we're moving away from fighting, and this is the new weapon, education.
Yeah. So rather
that's
than
the message.
that's really lovely, that symbolism and the idea that it's a tool now for advancement as opposed to
right. That's the new weapon, education.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Michael in Dallas. Hi, Michael.
Hi. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you.
Good. I just wanted to say something that was some things that was ironic. I'm doing a paper. I'm actually in school right now, and I'm doing a paper on the Middle Passage, and it's an extensive paper. And it's just ironic, some of the names, one of the first ships, and I may be mistaken in the name, but one of the first ships that went to get the slaves from Africa was named Oh Glory Jesus or something like that. It has the name of Jesus in the ship. Hmm. And it was just ironic that you were going to do something that was just so heinous and wrong, and the crew of the ship was such a Christian crew, and it blew me away. And then when I seen these paintings and other paintings I've seen in the past, it just, you know, really brings my paper to mind. And hearing these gentlemen on the phone, Mr. Collins and Mr. Robbins, I appreciate just you hearing you all. So I want to say thank you first. But can you elaborate on the Middle Passage and what, you know, the trials and tribulations that they had to go through?
Thanks so much for your call, Michael.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that. I was reading some diaries or accounts of some of the commanders and the ship owners, and they talked about how horrible the conditions were. And here were people who seemed to have just been doing their jobs, and they were not pleased. But the vivid description they gave of how there was a shipwreck once, or turbulent weather on a ship, and they had so many slaves on the ship turned capsized. So it threw a lot of slaves on top of each other, and the sheer weight of these other slaves smothered some of the other slaves. Some were injured, and they lost a lot of slaves. And in one account, they talked about how tragic things were happening to the slaves. They couldn't breathe, and the only concern the cargo owner had was that with the dying of these slaves, he was losing like $5,000 to $6,000 a run. And when you talk about the religious influence of this whole slave trade, you know, Amazing Grace came out of that situation. John Newton was one of these captain of a ship.
Trader.
And this thing finally got to him after a while that this ain't right. You know, he was a Christian and what have you. And that's how we got that song, Amazing Grace. And,
so he gave up trading slaves and transporting them and then wrote the song. I have never heard that story.
And most people, a lot of people think that Amazing Grace is a Negro spiritual in Africa. It is not. No. It was done by John Newton. Mm-hmm. But black folks used it because there was a message in there, you know, was grace that brought me, saved this far, and grace will lead me on. And there's hope. There's a message in that song. Mm-hmm. But the accounts of that Atlantic slave trip, you just would not believe some of the stuff that went on in there. And if you would email me at hrobinson@aamdallas.org, I would try to pull up some of those accounts. They're very short accounts. Some of them are very short. And I'll be willing to share those with you.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Donna in Dallas. Hi, Donna.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Well, I just wanted to congratulate Dr. Robinson. I've known him for years. This is Donna Clack, Dr. Robinson. And just to tell you of the wonderful job you're doing and the wonderful exhibit of the Talladega murals. It was absolutely fabulous. It blew me away. I even took my grandson, and he was very, very impressed. So thank you from all of us in Dallas for all the wonderful things you do.
Thank you for calling and send some other folks to see the exhibit.
Have you been able to sort of watch from a distance as people go through this for the first time? I'm curious about the reactions that you're seeing.
Yeah, the comment I got was from people who had never seen the murals, but were so excited about how bold they were and how they jump up. You know, I can understand some of us who had seen them when they were blurred and needed maintenance.
They've been cleaned and
we see
restored.
The contrast. Mm-hmm. But there were people who had never seen them before. Said, oh, my God, those murals jump out at you, the color, the boldness, you know.
One experience I had there was I was standing talking with someone else, and a gentleman walked up, and he was with a young lady, and he was commenting to this young lady that he was a student at Talladega, and he said, I walk through that card and that rotunda almost every day, and I never really saw those murals.
Isn't that interesting?
Until now. And he said, wow, look at this. This is something that I just did not know was there, you know.
And I was in one of the galleries or in the museum with one of our major supporters, and she was just blown away. And she sort of, you know, like the passage in the Bible where one guy went back to get his cousin, got his brother and brought him. Well, his brother said, I've got to go get so-and-so. I have to bring her here. I said, ah, I like that. You know, and the Bible says, and he brought him to Christ. Yeah. So I said, and she brought her to the museum.
Need more of that. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Rhonda on the line in Dallas. Hey, Rhonda.
Hi, hi. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Yes, first of all, Dr. Robinson, I wanted to let you know that there is sugar cane in Alabama. I am a native of Alabama and Georgia. And my
Well, I'm from Louisiana, you know, sugar cane capital.
<Yeah. laughs>
Well, my uncle grew acres and acres of it, and I chewed my way through a lot of stalks of it. So it is indeed there. But I'm also a proud graduate of a historically black college, university now, Clark Atlanta. I'm very proud to be a graduate there. And for a few years, I was actually the president of our local chapter here, actually helped start it with Maxie Marshall, who you maybe have been familiar with. I stepped away for a while to raise my family, and so now I'm getting back involved. But what I'm finding is that the younger people, meaning those that are, let's say, 40 and under, our chapter is back active again, is that we seem to have no real tie to the African American Museum. And I would like to know how we can collaborate together to bring this new group of people into the museum. I'm so excited about the exhibit, but had I not been a avid listener to KERA, for instance, I would not know about it. And I know that a lot of these younger people may not necessarily be listening to NPR. I've done my bit today tweeting about it and making some phone calls, but I think this is an opportunity that we really need to take advantage of to get these alumni clubs back involved with the African American Museum to really, really support, as you just said, go and get someone else to bring it, because this is a piece of history that we need not ignore for the next few months while it's in Dallas. I can't wait to get there myself, and I will certainly be bringing others, but I don't want to keep it to myself.
Well, Rhonda, let me jump in. We just have about 30 seconds left in the show, so maybe we can get a response to how we can get more younger people into the museum.
You're a woman after my own heart. Please call me. Please call me at 214-565-9026, extension 311. We have a lot of opportunities for you to get involved. We are trying to have a reunion of all of the graduates or former students of AUC institutions, Spelman, Morehouse, Clark, and what have you. So please call me, Rhonda. What's that last name?
We don't have Rhonda's last name,
okay.
Just because we don't take last names, but I'm sure she'll be able to get in touch
please
with you.
Please call me today.
Wonderful. And the exhibition goes through February 28th, so there's plenty of time, but maybe go early so you can go again. Is that the idea throughout the exhibition period? Dr. Harry Robinson is president of the African American Museum of Dallas. Philip Collins is retired curator for the museum. You can see Rising Up, Hale Woodruff's murals at Talladega College through February 28th. Gentlemen, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you
for having us.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces our podcast, and Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can find out about upcoming programs and download the podcast free every day at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.